Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us as we continue our exploration into the Little Tech agenda.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
So I want to start at the highest level of innovation policy. Obviously, that's an essential component of the origins of the Little Tech agenda, the substance of it. But zooming out even further, what should the goals of our innovation policy be at the national level?
What we've typically seen in the U.S. is a very light touch approach to general purpose technologies particularly. So if we think back about 30 years or so when the internet's coming about, you see things like the 1996 Telecom Act, you see things like the Clinton Framework for Global Electronic Commerce that really set this kind of quasi-libertarian vision of tech policy, of the idea that the government should only intervene when we actually see a true need to when it comes to a general purpose innovation. Otherwise, we should let entrepreneurs, innovators, investors, and consumers figure out what the appropriate applications for those innovations are. We saw this also with things like the 96 Telecom Act, which took a more deregulatory approach to various technologies in the telecom sector. And we've seen this even in areas that might be considered typically highly regulated. When we look at some of the things that have, for example, come out of the Department of Transportation in the first Trump administration, looking at trying to make sure that there weren't regulatory barriers to autonomous vehicles or driverless cars, we've seen times where various regulatory agencies have taken that reflective look of something that would really perhaps remove the barriers to entrepreneurship and innovation. This is in contrast to Europe, which has had a very top-down, come ask the government permission first approach that has really stifled innovation, stifled investment, and sought to regulate particularly American companies recently.
And I think it's fun to point out that this spirit of what Adam Thier, for example, has referred to as permissionless innovation, even if you go and look at some of the early policy papers around the birth of the internet, you can find Democrats, Republicans, basically everyone across the spectrum talking about what one FCC chair characterized as, quote, unregulation. And this idea that we'll wait to see, as you were pointing out, what's going to happen. And I wonder if it's your perception that we've maybe bought a little too much into the sci-fi movies and into the speculative harms of, oh, but it could lead to this horrible outcome. Let's jump on it now. But what's the risk of taking that sort of posture?
Well, while there's always been this kind of nonpartisan at time embrace around recognizing how many benefits innovation can have, there's also been this bit of nonpartisan doomerism, for lack of a better term. We can look at any array of technologies going back to things like the novel or the original cars or bicycles or Walkman and see that there was some sort of panic around what this technology was going to do to society, what this technology was going to do to traditional media at the time or various other things, just as there was oftentimes this particular optimism as well. And now the technology we're primarily talking about this application in is artificial intelligence or AI. And what we're seeing again is while we're seeing on both sides of the aisle, there are oftentimes people calling for more regulation out of a specific concern they may have. Some of those concerns are the same and some of them are at complete opposition with each other. We've also seen a lot of nonpartisan work in various task forces at both a federal and a state level that seem to really recognize there's an opportunity to make sure that we have the right kind of policy that will allow America to continue to be a leader in innovation as we move into this new era.
And I think it's critical to point that bipartisan history out, because even today we will hear in this series, for example, Sam Levine talking about how it's important to have enforcement of current laws and to see how our existing frameworks applying to current technology before saying we need some new massive regulatory ecosystem that may hinder that innovation that's so essential to America's entrepreneurial spirit and to its role as a leader in the tech space. But as we're kind of discussing, to riff off of sex sells, speculative harm cell too, right? It's really easy to say, hey, look at this one definitive harm. But it's a lot harder to show the opportunity cost, for example, of foreclosing what innovation could have come about. So driving this back to the little tech agenda, what is the fear of prioritizing a focus on little tech? Why might that lead to some of the missed opportunities or some of those opportunities costs that we were discussing?
Well, I think one of the good things about the idea of considering little tech in this conversation is when we're talking about regulation, we know that regulation creates barriers to entry that makes it more difficult for new players to enter the market. That larger players, while it will oftentimes cost them things and it will cost consumers things in the sense that they'll have to dedicate their time or their resources to compliance that may or may not improve the product in the way that they believe it should, oftentimes they can divert those resources. Now, they're diverting those resources. They're not just creating them out of nothing. But little tech players or medium-sized tech players may not have those resources. And that may put them in an awkward position of having to decide, do they even want to enter the market? Do they want to perhaps get acquired by someone who's more likely to have the resources to comply? Or do they want to look at a different area? And so in the end, it's not just the small players that potentially lose out on those products. It's the consumers in some cases as well. But I think it's important that we recognize that tech is an ecosystem and there are players of all sizes that are creating value in that. And we don't want to focus on an idea that says little tech is good and big tech is bad and medium tech is somewhere in the middle. It should be about creating a regulatory system and a policy system that allows innovation to occur at all levels of the ecosystem, that recognizes that these can be a symbiotic relationship, that it's not an either or, that sometimes the best pathway might be for a little tech company to get acquired so that they can reinvest that capital in creating a new product or that they can get their product to more consumers who are going to benefit from it and have the advantage of working with new teams to come up with new ideas. Oftentimes as well, when we think about regulation and we think about like a small business carve out or something, then that raises the question of, well, if your 50,000th and first user puts you over this threshold, does that become the most expensive user that you'll ever get? What do you do? Do you slow down at some point? Do you quit trying to compete because you don't want to run the risk of having that regulation? Or do you take on that extra cost? Does that change the market dynamics and force you into a kind of situation that you may not have been fully prepared for, particularly if a product gets very popular overnight. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll say in response to this question is there's also a kind of question of if the goal of regulation is to actually address a specific harm, does it matter the size of the company that did the harm itself? In other words, we should be looking at regulations that aren't about regulating an industry more generally or based in a presumption that big is bad, but what is the specific harm we're trying to prevent when it comes to this action? And in some cases, that can be done by a small player just as it can be done by a large player.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so valuable to point out those disproportionate compliance costs, even with the most well-intentioned regulation that, as we heard from Colin, strives to level the playing field by making sure that we're trying to take the unique needs and unique resources of little tech into consideration. Even when you attempt to do that, updating a privacy policy, as we'll hear from Kate Tamarello, can cost $4,000. That's not nothing. And there's not a, you know, money pot hanging out in the back of the startup's garage that they just get to pull from to pay for those regulatory costs. These are real considerations for these companies. And I want to dive deeper into a really key point and probably one of the most thorny issues of big tech acquiring little tech. Because depending on who you talk to, you'll hear two sides. One side will say it's great for big tech to acquire little tech because that's a great exit for little tech. If you're starting a company and you're thinking, hey, how is this going to go 10 years from now? Getting acquired is a pretty sweet deal in many cases, right? If you get multiples upon your initial valuation, you're making a good penny, and then you move on to your next project. On the other side, though, there's this idea of a kill zone or killer acquisitions, where we'll have a big tech company spot a nascent rival, someone who may develop into that medium-sized company or even that next big tech company. And so they swallow up that little tech company, take whatever innovation they were working on, kind of kick it to the side, and just make sure that never comes about. Where do you land, or how do you think through that wicked problem?
I think we need to be careful not to demonize acquisitions as always harmful or always bad. At the same time, we need to recognize that different innovators, different entrepreneurs will have different exit strategies, different things that they ultimately want to achieve with their companies. And what we ideally want is a mergers and acquisition system, a competition system, a market system that allows a variety of exit strategies. So for some innovators, you may really enjoy being an innovator, but you might not really enjoy being a business owner or running a business. And so you might be looking at wanting to sell that product, sell your business to a larger company that's going to want to do the business side of things, that's going to want to do those compliance side of things, so that you can then go and create another business, another innovation. And we have these kind of serial entrepreneurs, particularly in the tech sector, where they're selling one company, they're taking that, they're reinvesting it, and they're creating more value further down the line because they're investing that in a new product or a new idea. And we benefit as consumers because we get the existing product, we get the business acumen, and we also get the benefits of this new product and so on and so forth. In other cases, your product might actually be something that's improving another product, something that can be integrated into an existing product in ways that makes both of those products work better. And that's another reason why we might see someone want to be acquired that has nothing to do with the idea that big tech is trying to crush little tech from potentially competing. Then there are also people where they do want to be the next big thing. And I think there are a couple of things to remember in that regard too. The first is that we often say, you know, well, who's the next Google or who's the next Facebook? And the reality is the next Google, the next Facebook, as we've seen with the rise of artificial intelligence, might not look anything like Google or Facebook now, the same way that the previous era of tech giants, the next Nokia, the next Yahoo, don't really look like the original Nokia and Yahoos we would have been talking about at the time of those early internet laws. And so we've got to be careful not to make presumptions about what that next big thing is, because what we find is that regulators' crystal balls are not that great at predicting what the market in tech is going to evolve, particularly when innovation is such a key element of the competition policy. Yeah. And then if I can say one more thing on this, the other thing we have to consider is how hard it is to IPO. And that's something else we need to be asking ourselves. If our question is, you know, what are the exit strategies available for a company? Is there a case where we need to consider, or do we need to make it easier for companies to potentially go public? It's a long process. There's a lot of regulatory elements in there. Is this actually one of the barriers that, again, much like some of those other regulatory barriers, could be impacting the choices that an innovator makes?
Yeah, I really love how much context you're bringing to this conversation of, yes, there are edge cases where we can always say, hey, in this case, this does look like perhaps a killer acquisition. In the case of, let's say, Facebook and Instagram, there are people who would say that's kind of a quintessential killer acquisition. Some people may differ, but you really have to dive into the weeds of all of these different deals and these outcomes to understand, as you pointed out, what are the motivations of this founder? Do they even want to manage a medium-sized tech company? Maybe they don't. Maybe this has always been their ambition, and recognizing that can be really important. But I wonder, kind of on a all else equal, let's go into the land of the ivory tower. Sorry, it's where I spend a lot of my time. Given the incredible concentrations of power, economic power, political power, cultural power, that we now see big tech wield in a lot of conversations, should we have a sort of presumption or erring on the side more of little tech and finding more ways to make the competitive landscape as numerous as possible to try to prevent that sort of concentration? Or maybe those fears are being overblown. How do we think through this concentration issue?
I think we have to be cautious of this kind of mindset that there's a correct number of players in any particular market.
Eight?
You know, I think that's
yeah,
the concern is, right, if, you know, what is that number? And do we want the government to be the one that gets to dictate we need, you know, six social media apps at any time, you know, type of thing. Maybe the answer is 12. Maybe the answer is three big ones and 14 small ones. Who knows?
Whatever, you know, whatever the president's favorite number is.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. Like whatever, and how that could change in different administrations and things like that. So I think we have to be cautious of this idea that it's just an issue of quantity, and it's just an issue that big is always bad and small is always good, or vice versa, because different size tech companies are going to have different competitive advantages in the marketplace. And there are going to be times where large companies are going to have the resources to deeply invest in research and development in technologies that require a lot of capital to potentially get invested in and benefit those smaller companies as well from that research and development, from that groundwork that's laid. There are other times where small companies are going to be able to serve what may be very niche markets that might not actually be served by a large company, and also might have a finite number of resources available. So you can think of platforms that might be serving a particular community, whether it's a community of shared religious values, or platforms that might be designed to, say, help an individual with a disability, that there's only so many individuals that their market is, and that they're designed in a way that that's what their end product is, and they're probably going to stay a certain size with some variety.
Yeah. And what's interesting too about your point earlier about the different flavors of innovation and the different ways we see innovation come about. My dad worked for AT&T for 30 years, and a famous example of innovation by virtue of incredible scale is Bell Labs. Who knows when we would have received the transistor, for example, if we didn't have this massive company that had the ability to recruit and retain incredible experts who could then focus on that sort of basic R&D. And making sure we have that space for that sort of innovation is important as well.
So oftentimes AT&T is kind of brought up as this example of, you know, the time we needed antitrust in the tech space, you know, of yes, AT&T was innovative, but it wasn't as innovative as it could have been. You know, Bell Labs was great, but what might we have had? I think it's first off important to remember what actually gave us competition in the phone sector is not necessarily the breakup of AT&T, it's innovation. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that we now have voice over internet calling, that we now have Zoom, that we now have mobile phones. When was the last time you asked who your long distance provider is even? You know, probably some of the folks listening to this podcast don't even know what a long distance provider is. And so there's that element of it, but there's also the element that one of the things that makes the current tech ecosystem different from that kind of case is that we do see these large companies still competing with one another and still competing in this global dynamic as well with international companies, whether it's in China or Europe or the Middle East, that this is a global competition, and that it's also competition with one another. You think about something like AI, and you have a range of both large players and small players heavily invested, some of whom are names many people have already heard of. Some of them are names that, you know, who had heard of OpenAI before 5 or 10 years ago, you know, that we hadn't heard of, or that were not as well known. You think of something like NVIDIA that has been in the chips industry for a while, but for many people, it wasn't a household name until, again,
the video game folks
ago.
Knew about
again,
it.
But the video
we were all in the dark besides them.
And things like that. And so I think it's that's what makes this a bit distinct from what we had seen there. The other thing that's important to remember is also the role that regulation can play in preventing competition. So when we start to see things like calls for licensing regimes, or calls for government-directed resources, that could actually create a monopoly rather than creating more competition.
Let's drill down on that a little bit more about how a lot of legislators will say things like, hey, because we have that carve-out, we're going to make sure that it doesn't impact startups or it doesn't lead to a chilling effect on innovation because we've said this only applies to the biggest of the bigs. We've talked a little bit about this in the series, but I want to hear your perspective on the unintended consequences of regulation.
I think there are a couple things with that. The first of which is we have to remember the biggest of the bigs, it's oftentimes very hard to define what makes a big tech company. If you think about particularly some of those mid-sized tech companies, your Reddits, your Blue Skies, your Discords of the world, where they might seem more popular. They're not necessarily household names, but they might actually meet some of these thresholds of users. And they might have entire staffs of tens or hundreds, as opposed to thousands or millions of folks working for these companies that now have to deal with these potential regulatory concerns. And that means that oftentimes we're going to see very tough decisions have to be made. It may mean not offering a product in a particular region at times, whether that's a state or a federal level. It also may mean that you're taking the resources and investing in compliance rather than investing in actually improving your product, the type of things we want to see happen with AI innovation, the type of things we want to see happen with new players kind of creating a new idea that we hadn't thought of that doesn't look like what we've seen before. And it may actually have this bit of a chilling effect, as you alluded to, the idea of it may make you more risk averse. It may make you less likely to go and try something new because there might be a concern that if you try it, the government's going to come and shut it down. And so do you want to take that risk, whether that risk is an acquisition or whether that risk is launching a new product, given a regulatory environment, even if it's not currently regulated, that seems primed to regulate it. So think about, for example, what we're seeing in Europe right now with the combination of antitrust regulation in the Digital Markets Act and AI regulation in the AI Act. We've seen several American companies not launch certain AI products over there because they're concerned that even if they think it might be compliant, that if it's deemed not, the risk of those fines is so impactful on that particular business that it's not worth the market share that they would have, that it's not worth that regulatory risk. Now imagine what that might be if you're a smaller company. We saw this again, looking to Europe with GDPR, and which is the data privacy law over there. And we're not just talking about tiny two guys in a garage startups, although they are certainly impacted by these too. We're talking about companies like the LA Times that initially pulled out of Europe under the GDPR because it wasn't worth it for their market share.
Well, I don't know who reads the LA Times anyway, but no, that's another joke. So looking at the broader picture of a sort of all tech is tech approach, what is your advice for the biggest advocates of the little tech agenda? Is it time for a rebrand to say just the tech agenda or the innovation agenda? Because I wonder if there's a sort of risk of anytime you label one thing, the kind of natural response is to say, oh, well, that means there's an other group, right? And maybe the little tech agenda, by virtue of holding up little tech, perpetuates the stigmatization of big tech. So are you hoping for a rebrand, or what would you like to see the little tech agenda change about kind of its approach?
I think it should be a innovation occurs at all sizes agenda, to your kind of point of we want something that recognizes that, yes, little companies are particularly burdened by regulatory changes. And they're also particularly at risk if we shift away from that light touch policy. So think about something like Section 230. Oftentimes we'll hear critics of Section 230 say, oh, it's a shield for big tech. But it's oftentimes the smaller players who are going to struggle most if they're facing that kind of litigation, who are not going to be able to launch products that can serve particular communities, provide new platforms for speech, provide new competitors in these ecosystems. Because even if they are ultimately vindicated in court, they still have all those court costs, which for a small player can be incredibly risky in terms of the financial sector. Or if you do have investors, can chill investors from wanting to potentially invest in your company. So I do think we have to recognize that, yes, smaller players oftentimes are disproportionately burdened by regulation because they don't have those resources they can divert. But we do need to recognize that what has allowed big players to emerge, what has created the fact that the U.S. is a leader in technology. I prefer to say, you know, U.S. technology leaders as opposed to big tech, because that's what these companies are. They're global technology leaders that were fortunate, were based here in the U.S. And as a result, that we can really, that all started off small, and that having that light touch policy, having that innovation policy is what allows us to have an environment that is ripe for the next generation of global leaders to emerge at all sizes of the tech ecosystem.
And we're speaking just a few days after the release of the AI Action Plan, and there have been a number of executive orders that have come about following that plan. And a question that seems to be lurking behind a lot of the recent actions from the administration is that concern about bigger companies having more leverage with respect to shaping our culture. And so, for example, there are new procurement expectations that before the federal government agrees to a contract with an AI company, they want to see that it's been trained in a way that will result in some sort of objective truth. And I'm wondering if this kind of approach of being fearful of big tech's influence on culture, if you think that's outsized or if that aligns with kind of how you see the tech regulatory ecosystem and the tech ecosystem generally operating.
Look, every individual can have different preferences when it comes to which companies you choose to trust, whether it's for information or whether it's for the technology you use. The same way that different people have different preferred newspapers or different preferred TV channels or different preferred sports teams, Kevin.
Hook 'em. I'm sorry, we cannot say the words roll tide.
You know, that people can want different things from their technology as well. And it's important to think, though, what happens, though, when we change from those consumer preferences where, you know, I might want a AI that's always going to tell me that the University of Alabama is the top football team in the SEC.
That sounds like a hallucination. Yeah.
But that we can have different preferences in terms of things that are oftentimes broader are a bit subjective, like who's the best football team. And yet when we start to see these things put into policy is when it raises concerns. And it raises concerns in a couple of ways. One is the potential impact on free speech. Do we have the government dictating what different platforms can and can't carry, what they must or what they must carry as well? And how does that impact our free speech rights as citizens, our rights to information? So that's one element there. The other question, too, is, again, what does this mean for the smaller players? When you start to see a lot more requirements around what you must be able to show your algorithm can do, what you must show that it can't do, does that mean that it makes it harder for smaller players to perhaps compete in some cases around some of these elements? So I think oftentimes we assume that these things are going after certain companies when they could actually have a much broader impact. And when we also have much more diversity between those companies as well. And when we've seen them respond to consumer demands, we've seen changes in content moderation policies, whether it's Meta adding community notes, whether it's changes at X under Elon Musk, whether it's also, though, the emergence of platforms like Blue Sky for people who found themselves frustrated with some of those changes and wanted a more decentralized approach that allowed them to have more control. So we've seen a variety of options if we look at things like social media or the internet era, and I think we're still seeing that in AI. We're still seeing that we're seeing a lot of competing models. We're seeing a lot of different competing ways in developing those models, things like open source and closed source models, things that occur at different levels, different types of applications. And so I think that's where we need to be cautious about the idea, well, this will only go after big tech or only after the companies that we don't like or whatever. And I would also, again, caution anyone, whichever party is in power of the government, to recognize once a government has power, it's very difficult to get that power back. And so would you want the person you most disagree with to have this same power, I think is an important question to ask yourself when we're talking about technology and when we're talking about speech.
Well, there are plenty of outstanding regulatory questions that I know you are working hard at, and I don't want to delay you any further from that important work. So I'll end with a bit of a challenging question that I've been asking each of our participants, which is 5 years from now, what are we saying about the Little Tech Agenda?
I think we're saying it's just the way we call the light touch approach to innovation in this era. I think that hopefully what it recognizes is why overregulation can be so harmful to innovators and to consumers. That what we were really trying to focus on was continuing that tradition that has created an ecosystem that allows America to be the place where a guy in a garage with an idea can take that and give us all something we never dreamed of.
Well, thank you so much for joining the podcast, Jennifer. This was a heck of a lot of fun.
Thank you, Kevin.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.